I conclude today's lecture or talk by offering you some basic principles of prayer that I think need to be remembered. And this is all on the web, if you can get it off the web, if you want. It will be. It's not on yet, but it will be by the time I get to bed tonight, please God. But I think there's a lot of... I've picked this up from everywhere, of course, but I think there's a lot of wisdom in it. And I outline this in chapter 11 of the book there, some basic principles to be kept in mind when we reflect on prayer. So, first, it's important not to forget that since prayer is loving communion with God, and since God is always the one to begin the communion, so prayer is responding to God, not initiating contact. The best prayer is the prayer that God is offering. So let's gratefully accept and treasure whatever communion God is offering us now, for God knows our present capacity to respond. We need to remember that to turn towards God is already to be in prayer. In fact, I saw Dad the night before he died. I had to come up from Victoria to do so. And the only prayer Dad prayed, and the one he's in hospital in the last few days, was the word Jesus, just the name Jesus. That was his only prayer. Can't do better. So whatever prayer you have will depend on your health, on what's happened, who rang up, what letter you didn't get, what's happened economically in the family, what's happened to your children, all of that affects you. So pray the way you can, because that's the best prayer. It's you. Second principle. We must constantly remind ourselves that God is offering us this intimacy. And you have to remember that, or you might do what I did last night after I call it busy anyhow. You might think, you mums and grandmas and grandpas probably think my life's just a dream, really. But it seems busy to me anyhow. And Mark, the assistant priest there, got this video out of the shop called something. And it was meaningless, really. A bad film, badly produced film. On there, my intellect's thinking, you know, they should have done that and should have... But the story had some interest. It was called Jump, that's right. Anyhow, I just flaked out a bit. And then I saw it through to the end, because I thought, I want to see how it ends. And then when it ended and I turned off, I thought, what a waste of time. There's 100 things. I could have listened to Beethoven, but I didn't. I just finished this thing off, so... And my excuse was I was tired, and I was tired. But do you see what I did? I kind of vegged uncreative, unhelpful way. Now, there's my confession. You want to make yours? So, to remember that God is offering us the communion. So, I could have gone in and just relaxed somewhere and let the communion happen. Thirdly, another principle. The value or quality of our prayer is measured by the fruit which it produces in our lives. That's vital. In every parish I've ever been in, and I'm, you know, there are people who pray and pray and pray and pray and pray, and they criticise and criticise and criticise and criticise and criticise, and they're like a lemon, wrinkled outside and bitter within, and they're praying all the time. So what on earth is happening? Now, it's not up to me to judge them, and I'm not looking at anyone in particular. No, but I mean, you know what I'm trying to say. If it's prayer, you will necessarily become gentler, humbler, more truthful, more sensitive to other people. I mean, you have to, because it's Jesus. You're becoming Christ. So if that's not happening, then all the prayers you're saying, something's going very radically wrong, so give yourself a break. Get out of the cage. Start again somewhere else. Because that's how you're going to know. Our humility, and you can hear the humility in my criticism of others. Can you feel it coming out? Humility, especially our love. Teresa writes, it is in the effects and deeds following afterwards that one discerns the true value of prayer. Obvious once said, but radical, important to reflect on. Fourthly, whatever happens, Teresa tells us, we must not abandon prayer. And if we do, she offers the only remedy, begin again. It's okay. Begin again. Don't. So a person hasn't been praying for 5 years, and they spend the next year thinking, gee, I haven't been praying for 5 years. That makes it six. So it would be a much better thing, once you become aware, to just humbly kneel down and say, Lord, and God says, it's all right, sweetheart, she's okay, we'll sort it out. And in a few minutes he sorts it out. What's time? Do you know what I mean? So get on with it and start again, have another go, start again. Fifthly, we shouldn't expect the journey. Some people write books on prayer. God, I've done it myself. And then you read Teresa of Avila, and it looks like you're going through the seven mansions, and you're trying to think, what mansion am I in, see? Mansion number four. Well, you'd expect mansion number five to come after four, wouldn't you? But I have to tell you, after four comes 2, 1, 3, 7, 6, 5, but mostly you're probably in four at this stage. And then one day you wake up and thank be to God, you're in five. And when you're in five, don't try and reproduce it tomorrow, because five, tomorrow, well, you're back at 1, 2, 8, 7. There's only 7. 8's just beyond this world. So it's not a progression thing. It's a real thing, like life. There's no stage of prayer so sublime that it's not necessary often to return to the beginning. And Thérèse of Lisieux says, sometimes all she could do in prayer was say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be. God help us, can you do better than that? If you're saying it from the heart, you can't do better than that. Or the Hail Mary. Because she couldn't think, couldn't pray, couldn't get into, she was too tired and too sick, tuberculosis, died at 24, freezing cold convent, you know, no understanding of things, and probably freezing cold nuns she lived with too, probably some, you know, like all over the place, human beings in other words. So all she could do was fall back on the Hail Mary and the Our Father. And if that's all you can do and you do that, you're a saint. Sixthly, here's the point I guess I've been making all morning. Oh, it's important to follow the advice of Teresa, set our eyes on Christ. Can't go wrong. And if sometimes it takes you into an ecstasy and you don't know where you are, go. Come back to him. Jesus will journey with us, leading us to a deeper knowledge of the true God, our knowledge that comes through love. He will also lead us to a deeper knowledge of our real selves. It's in Jesus we see what it means to be made in the image and likeness of God. You don't actually see yourself by looking at yourself. I think that's true. And just reflect on your own life. I would be surprised if we're any different in this. I think I've learned about myself by looking into other people's eyes. Because we see people usually better than, if you love the person, I mean, I'm assuming love. People who love you see you better than you see yourself. They teach you who you are. That's how it all started. Mum, dad, lovers show you something because they're free of memories of who you, what you've done, and they see you for who you are. Isn't that what we do with our children? Michelangelo used to look at hunks of marble that no one else could touch. The one that's now David in Firenze, was a piece of marble no one could do anything with because it was unshapely. And he looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, and one day he saw David in it. So he chipped away the bits that enabled others to see what he'd seen. Isn't that what you do with your children? You chip away this bit of behaviour and you leave them sitting the way my mother left me sitting on the back veranda somewhere in my distant memory because I had some popcorns and I didn't share them. So I sat on that back veranda on my own with this load of popcorns. I presume they let me in. I'm still alive, but there was no way. I had to learn a lesson that you don't have popcorns that you don't share. Well, I haven't had any popcorn since, I think, but if I promise I'd share them if I had some. No, I'd have to, because you chip away to reveal. Well, we are made in the image of God. So Jesus, by looking at him, you learn who you are. Agony in the garden, you see. And in a way, you can look at him all your life in the agony in the garden, but it's only when you have an agony in the garden that you actually see, isn't it? So it's a mutual enlightenment that goes on. But he gives us the images that help us see what's happening at a deeper level. We see who we're called to be. Furthermore, we see by comparison how sinful we are. And this is so true. I remember I was a young priest, 24 years old, innocent as anything I was in those days. God, I wish I was still innocent. But anyhow, I had to grow up, I suppose, and growing up has a little bit to do with sin, I'm told. All you experts, would that seem right? No, I was willing to say anything. So, but I was an innocent little 24-year-old and a dear old priest. I can't remember who he was, but I just remember he was the humblest bloke in the community at Kensington, and I was just visiting, and he asked me to hear his confession. So, you're priests, you do that. And he confessed to being proud. I'm not supposed to tell what happens in confession, but I can't remember who it was, and you don't know who it was, so it doesn't matter here. But I just want to tell you what I had. I had two immediate feelings. One, two, like that. Thank God I had the second one so quickly. The first one was, I didn't understand what he was saying because he's the humblest person in the community, you see. And he's saying how sins of pride. But the second thought, which was a good thought, was, of course, of course. Proud people don't confess pride because they don't notice it. It's only the more humble you are, the more you notice the least little movement of pride that other people wouldn't see. If you're a kind of blucher boots person that drives over people's lives and treads down everybody, I'll never hear you in confession saying, I was very hard on someone. They don't do it, I can tell you. The person that tells you they're hard on someone is this beautiful, sensitive person who picks up that they were insensitive. Do you get me? Of course you do. That's how it works. So the more saintly you are, the more you're aware of sin in your life. Don't let it drag you just because you... It's obvious, isn't it? So this acts as a warning. It nurtures humility and safeguards us from thinking that any value we have comes from ourselves. And if someone comes up to you and thanks you, I'm giving you good advice here because priests cop a lot of this, and it's okay. If someone comes up and says how wonderful you are and thanks you for what you've done, don't be hard on them. Inside, you might know that, oh dear, maybe, but you let them have the pleasure of thanking you and you just take it lightly and you let it go lightly, don't you? You don't, because you're not doing it for that and you don't feel, because you're just you. And they need to say this, and it's lovely that they do, and it is affirming, and maybe it's a grace from God. So just accept it lightly, and then let it go lightly. Don't let it make any difference to your own self-image, because self-image is not what we're talking about. Prayer helps us look at the wonder of God, and the wonder of Jesus, and the wonder of everybody around us. And surely that's what it's about. This nurtures humility, safeguards us from thinking we're of any value that cut from ourself. It's not a bad self-image you've got, it's just a grateful Mary dancing for joy, saying, my soul magnifies the Lord because he's done wonderful things for me. He has done wonderful things. But she's not thinking, I'm terrific. She thinks, gee, isn't God good? Don't you think that's good? It reinforces our longing to gaze on God, who's the sole source of all of this. Now, seventhly, if we're serious about prayer, we must resolve to turn away from sin. Sin blocks out the light of God and opens our soul to darkness. It's a very radical thing, and we have to learn to hate it and to stop it. Ask God to grace us. We'll need a resolute will to detach ourselves from whatever is cluttering up our lives and holding us back. John of the Cross has a beautiful image of a bird and it's got a little silk thread tying it to the branch. Or it could have a big hunk of string, you know. Doesn't matter. You can't fly. You have to break the last little thread to be able to fly. And some of us get rid of some things. We hang on to something else, you know. So it's that need. When God calls, not when you think it's a good idea, but when God calls you to, and you know when that happens, and you're called to love, you have to let go of whatever's holding you back. We'll need that resolute will. This will vary from person to person and according to each one's state of life. The rich young man, people get caught up in that. And Jesus said, let your possessions go and come join us. He said it to the rich young man. He didn't say it to Joseph of Arimathea. So he mightn't say it to you. It's whatever's holding you back. Some people, wealth doesn't hold them back from love. In fact, they become instruments of love through it. I don't, you know, it's nothing that's ever troubled my family. We had, but it does. And so we don't judge others and we don't copy others. And we don't decide what we're going to give up. We get called by love. And when love says, let it go, we let it go. And if love doesn't say let it go, we hold it close. If we're serious about prayer, we must try to live virtuous lives in obedience to God's will as revealed to us through the ordinary means of God's providence. We must not look for consolation. We have to learn to embrace the cross. I don't know how you do it. I don't like the cross. And I read Teresa of Avila and she talks about embracing it. And I say to Teresa of Avila, I haven't got a clue what you're talking about, but I'm not into embracing crosses. Not yet. One of you might help me. By the time I'm 91, I might have learnt to do it. But my image, if you find the cross too hard to embrace, embrace the one on the cross, Jesus, and he embraces you. And maybe we're embracing the cross more than we think we are too. But we have to learn to do it. Not create a cross. Don't go. I mean, life's full of crosses, isn't it? But don't go looking for it. Some people seem to invent them. And you think, God help us, what are you bothering with that for? I mean, but you get enough real ones. Though we need to be careful not to be too self-reliant, or I need to be careful not to be too self-reliant, maybe you. This doesn't mean that we should be overly reliant on others and fail to appreciate the gift of God that we are as well as the gifts that God has given us. But it does require that we keep alert to the truth that all we are and all we have is a gift. So we live simply with gratitude. We're to listen to Jesus reminding us to become like a child in recognizing our dependence on God and relying on God's grace. Finally, and this is my conclusion, while there is some value in studying prayer from the outside, we'll only truly be helped to the extent that we're actually praying. You can learn about love. You can get a PhD at the university on love and never hold hands. Holding hands is okay, is it? Good. I mean, you know, you don't know anything. It's only if you pray that you can discover what prayer is. You know that. Without praying, we can learn what God is doing in people's lives. We can get some idea of the intimate communion to which God is inviting us. Yes. However, we can understand what other people tell us about prayer only to the extent that their words shed light on our own personal experience of prayer. Teresa herself tells us this. And I finish with this quote from her book on her life. As much as I desire to speak clearly about these matters of prayer, and no one has spoken more clearly than her, they will be really obscure for one who has not had experience.